Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, October 27th, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Berkeley-based Street Story app helps promote traffic safety in Humboldt, fairness debated as Humboldt vehicle miles policy approved, so stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkyon, Wailaki, Wiat, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
In a story previously aired this month on KMUD News, a report made by the Coalition for Responsible Traffic Priorities, CRTP, detailing traffic safety suggestions that Caltrans could make to improve driving conditions and pedestrian safety on the 4th and 5th Street corridor in Eureka. The report found that despite only making up 0.2% of the county's road miles, 18% of Humboldt County's pedestrian fatalities happened there. When gathering information to help inform this report, CRTP partnered with UC Berkeley's SafeTrex program, Street Story. Street Story is a community engagement platform designed to allow community members to gather information about and report crashes, near misses, traffic hazards, and more. KMUD News spoke with Lucia Ornelas, project and program analyst for UC Berkeley SafeTrek, for more information on the program.
Our Street Story platform was created by a team of city planners, public health professionals, engineers, social welfare experts, and computer scientists at UC Berkeley's Safe Transportation Research and Education Center, or SafeTrek, in 2019. Funded by the California Office of Traffic Safety, Street Story is a community engagement platform that allows residents, community groups, and agencies to collect information about transportation crashes, near misses, general hazards, and safe locations to travel. Street Story can be used in any city or county in California, and it's available for California residents ages 13 and older.
Not only is the program used to inform community members about potential hazardous roads and crashes, organizations and agencies work with the program, much like CRTP and Humboldt. Ornelas elaborates more on how the program is used with different agencies.
Street Story can be used to complement current transportation safety efforts, and it has been used in many different ways over the years. For example, Caltrans District 4 used Street Story to collect community feedback as part of their pedestrian plan outreach, and a nonprofit in Bakersfield worked with local agencies to use Street Story as a supplement to the separate city and county reporting system. Community groups can also use Street Story to provide qualitative support to community-led improvement efforts or projects, especially in areas where crash data does not fully show or capture the community's lived experiences. I also wanted to highlight Street Story provides the option for a custom boundary to gather input within the selected area. For example, using a custom boundary creates a personalized link and a QR code that can be shared with the community so that data can be collected in an area of interest or area of focus. After the reports for the area have been entered into the Street Story database, the collected data can be integrated into a report that demonstrates the need for safety measures by the community reports and documentation that's entered into Street Story.
CRTP started working with Street Story in 2019 by promoting the program in partnership with SafeTrek. Later, in 2024, CRTP and Safe Story partnered again to conduct community engagement work across Humboldt County to improve pedestrian safety conditions. Here's Ornelas with more.
So the Coalition for Responsible Transportation Priorities, or CRTP, began promoting Street Story in Humboldt County on California's North Coast in 2019 in partnership with SafeTrek. CRTP is a nonprofit organization in Humboldt County who aims to promote transportation solutions that protect and support a healthy environment, healthy people, healthy communities, and a healthy economy on the North Coast. In 2024, CRTP and SafeTrek partnered again to conduct Street Story engagement work across Humboldt County through grassroots outreach and across various different platforms. This work focused on communication and outreach in Humboldt County. So this included educating the public about Street Story using different strategies, providing technical assistance and training to local agencies and community groups, as well as distributing information about Street Story at community events and meetings. CRTP also posted about Street Story on their social media platforms and in their weekly newsletter called The Collector. These engagement efforts throughout the county resulted in an uptick in the number of reports that were submitted monthly to Street Story, a finding that was highlighted in the 2024 CRTP Street Story Outreach in Humboldt County final report, which is also published on their website. CRTP also published a data analysis report, which analyzed approximately 5 years of Street Story data collected in the county from 2019 through March of 2024. It highlights many narratives from Street Story reports to give the reader direct insight into community members' experiences using the roadway. This report provides a robust examination of community reports from the Street Story tool, draws attention to the information in these reports, and it aims to spark further conversations about how to address the issues identified by Street Story users.
In a clip from our previous story about CRTP's traffic safety report, Colin Fisk, executive director of CRTP, encourages and elaborates on how community members can utilize Street Story.
I just want to encourage people, if they're not familiar with the Street Story platform, so it's streetstory.berkeley.edu. It was developed by a team at UC Berkeley, and it's really easy to make a report of places that you think are hazardous or where you've had a near miss or even a crash. And people use it throughout the county. We have 1,500 reports or so in Humboldt County already. But if folks aren't familiar with it, I encourage them to go on there and make their own reports, because that really helps us to advocate for safety improvements and local agencies to know what folks are thinking and prioritize their funding too.
For more information about Street Story, the website is streetstory.berkeley.edu. For more information about CRTP's collaboration with the program, the website is transportationpriorities.org/street-story/. There was an urban versus rural debate as Humboldt County's Board of Supervisors approved a policy that makes complying with state law on analyzing vehicle use more streamlined. Daniel Mintz reports.
State law requires counties to include vehicle miles traveled, VMT, in environmental reviews, and a new Humboldt County policy streamlines the process for projects in areas with less vehicle use. But the fairness of the policy was debated as the county's Board of Supervisors approved it at its October 21st meeting. As of July 2020, state law requires analysis of vehicle use in environmental reviews. Part of achieving the goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, vehicle impacts are now gauged using miles traveled as a basis rather than factors like traffic congestion. The county's VMT impact analyses are done on a case-by-case basis now. A policy to make the process less burdensome in areas where there are less vehicle trips per day was before supervisors. The idea is to spare projects from having to do VMT analysis if they're in low VMT areas or meet criteria such as being small-scale or affordable housing. But the streamlining benefit is mostly in urbanized areas. Conditions in rural areas like southern Humboldt were discussed in this exchange between Planning Director John Ford and Board Chair Michelle Bushnell.
A project, multifamily project that was 12 to 13 units, multifamily 12 to 13 units would screen out under the small project criteria.
Larger than 13?
They would need to do a VMT analysis if they're subject to CEQA, yes.
And so that could affect larger building units down in that area?
It could. If they were doing an affordable project, they wouldn't be subject to this.
Right, I understand that.
Yeah.
The basis for determining whether a project will have significant VMT impacts is a threshold level that's set at 15% of the baseline or existing level, measured in per resident vehicle miles traveled per day. Two options were presented for setting the baseline: using data only from the county's unincorporated areas or going countywide and including incorporated city areas. The distinction is important because the per resident VMT baseline for the unincorporated area is greater than the countywide calculation that includes cities. The lower the baseline, the the more likely projects will be required to mitigate VMT impacts. There were different takes on the effects of the policy, as shown in this exchange between Supervisor Mike Wilson, Ford, and Bushnell.
So this isn't a prohibition necessarily. It's actually, we're just talking about taking layers off of the analysis in some cases. We're not talking about adding analysis.
Correct.
Right.
This should streamline analysis,
right,
where we do actually have to do VMT analysis.
So there's nothing that we're doing that's making anything more difficult.
That's not a true statement.
Ford said rural areas that have community plans would be exempted, but Bushnell said most of Southern Humboldt isn't designated that way.
Community plan areas in the Southern Humboldt area are very small, and construction goes outside of those community plan areas very often, including the Shelter Cove area. And so those folks would have to, they would be required to adhere to this. Is that a correct or not?
That is correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so, and I mean, I know it seems, we've had that discussion a lot between us, is the whole fairness of it.
Yeah.
But what we're being asked to do by the state, both from a traffic perspective and a greenhouse gas emissions perspective, and they are related, is to reduce the number of miles people
drive.
No,
I understand. But also it hits into the Carlotta and Hydesville area as well. There are many parcels out there that are out of community plan areas.
A motion to approve the policy using the countywide baseline was approved 4-1, with Bushnell voting against. Explaining her no vote, Bushnell said, quote, "This is my constituent base, and that's what I'm here for." In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Turning to Mendocino, Hopland Public Utility District to pay for a Caltrans project for utility relocations, Mendo Local News' Elise Cox reports.
It's an unfair burden that's well known to state legislatures who represent rural districts. When a Caltrans project affects water or sewer lines, it's the local water district, not the state, that has to pay to move them. Whether the move is temporary or permanent, and even if it doesn't benefit the utility at all, the local district foots the bill. I'm Elise Cox, reporting for KMUD News and MendoLocal.news. This policy recently forced a 40% rate increase for customers of the Hopland Public Utility District. The increase takes effect November 1st. One out of three ratepayers opposed it. Assemblymember Chris Rogers, who represents California's 2nd Assembly District, says the law simply doesn't work for small rural systems.
And I think that this is a really good example of one of the areas where one-size-fits-all approaches to policy are a challenge across California, but specifically in our district, being as large as it is, right? We have the Trinity Public Utility District. We have the McKinleyville Community Service District. We have a ton of these small organizations in our rural communities. And so the ideal would have been to solve it for everybody. But we even acknowledged the entire time that we were doing this bill for Hopland.
Under state law, Caltrans can fund road construction and accessibility upgrades, but not the cost of relocating water or sewer lines in the way. That meant Hopland's tiny district, about 330 ratepayers, was expected to come up with as much as $2 million for underground utility work tied to a Caltrans Americans with Disabilities Act project through downtown Hopland.
So the fact that they are having the secondary aspect of this project that isn't even their project, but it's a Caltrans project, fall on so few people at such a high cost, it really would be a challenge for that district.
Rogers introduced a bill earlier this year to let Caltrans pay for those utility relocations. He estimated Hopland's share at between $1 and $2 million, depending on labor, materials, and how long the project takes to begin. His bill passed both houses of the legislature with overwhelming bipartisan support. But Governor Gavin Newsom vetoed it on October 3rd, saying it could set a precedent for other small water and community service districts across California. Still, Rogers says there's good news.
We also worked very closely with Senator McGuire's office and made sure that we secured some funding that was directly earmarked for this project in the state's budget as well at the end of session. So that's about $1.5 million was the amount that we got in statute to be able to go towards this project.
Rogers says that money remains available despite the governor's veto.
But because we have that funding still secured, there still is going to be the ability for the second portion of this project to move forward. We just have to make sure that the money gets allocated that originally was designed to be allocated to Caltrans for the project. Probably the workaround is going to be that it'll be reallocated to the public utility district or to the county to actually be the implementer of the project.
He says the administration and lawmakers are still figuring out how to move the money, but the commitment to finish the project remains.
So even without the policy portion of it, having secured the funding for it, the project will still get done. We just need to make sure that we, you know, dot the T's, cross the I's to make sure that it all works correctly.
Rogers credits the effort's success to bipartisan teamwork and to local advocates who kept the issue alive.
We were very happy to work on the bill. We worked very closely with Supervisor Madeline Klein. She's been nothing but the biggest champion. We talked with the former supervisor, Glenn McGordy, about it. And he's been a huge champion. And then obviously the work that Senator McGuire has done to be able to help secure that funding as the pro tem just can't be understated.
For Hopland and other small rural communities, a successful outcome could provide hope that they can get the state's attention and get relief when laws don't make sense.
And now we are at a point where we feel pretty good about it. Still have a little bit of work to do on it, but at least we have that money that has been secured.
For KMUD News and MendoLocal.News, I'm Elise Cox.
In state news, Valley farmers blast raids and deportations of undocumented workers back Dignity Act path for workers to stay. KPFA's Vic Bedoyan reports.
Farmers and other industry leaders in the San Joaquin Valley are expressing growing concerns over the way immigration actions have impacted their businesses and their workers. Manuel Cuna is president of the Nisei Farmers League. It started in 1971 as a support group for Japanese American farmers. Now its membership includes other ethnicities, and it advocates for farmers and farm workers across the state. Cuna says the group is upset over the way workers have been treated by the federal government.
We have seen a huge reduction of the Walmart or the Home Depots and all that stuff. We've seen a tremendous curtailment of that stopping. It's not as rapid as it was. What we are seeing, which I believe is wrong, is those people that have appointments and they've been here working and they're clean, they're good, and they're just going to go in now to renew their extension. They are hauled off. But they're told, we can take you or you can voluntarily depart. So at that stage in time, what would you say? I will voluntarily depart because why? I might have a chance to come back.
Cuna opposes workplace raids and courthouse kidnappings that detain hardworking and law-abiding people and break up families who are the backbone of the Valley's key industries, agriculture, food processing, and construction.
All of this impacts our rural communities. I'm talking about Orange Grove, California. I'm talking about Avenel. I'm talking about Parlier, where there are 9,000, 8,000, 7,000, 12,000, 20,000 people live in those communities. They make up that construction, the restaurant, the agriculture industry. And if we go in there and start yanking everybody out because of the documentation that Congress has failed to deal with for 30-plus years, then shame on us.
In response, leaders from those essential businesses got together to push for legislation that will resolve the deportation crisis. The Immigration Reform Frontline Worker Alliance was formed to promote a bill in Congress, H.R. 4393, called the Dignity Act. It is sponsored by Florida Republican Maria Salazar and Veronica Escobar of Texas and has bipartisan support. The Dignity Act combines strong border security measures with a legal pathway for immigrants who are already here to stay in the U.S. Guna says Valley businesses and workers would benefit.
That Dignity Act addresses all industries, not just agriculture. Today, agriculture is not by itself. Because if I lose the workers in the restaurants, what happens to my restaurants? They close down. I lose those sales of products going there. I hit the hotels. I lose the hotel service of the food part of this. If I hit the construction industry, I don't build houses for people, for industry people and everybody. So agriculture has to look at this, and the way we've been looking at it is that we're in this all together, one for all for one.
Under the Dignity Act, undocumented workers would register while in the country and get legal status for 7 years through federally qualified entities. Then they could renew for another 7 years. Eventually, people could become permanent residents and citizens. People brought here as children who are in the DACA program would also be able to gain legal resident status, allowing them to safely stay here and travel abroad. Kuna concedes the bill is not perfect, but says he believes the Dignity Act provides the best opportunity the nation has to repair a broken and now weaponized immigration system. Kuna says even the sports world is getting involved with a meet-and-greet event in Fresno featuring world champion boxers called The Fight for Dignity.
The Fight for Dignity, we believe, will help the author out of Florida and the author out of Texas do this universally. And once and for all, let's deal with immigration and get it done right.
In Central Valley counties, ICE arrests in the first 7 months of 2025 increased dramatically compared to 2024. According to the UC Berkeley Deportation Data Project, some 1,156 individuals have been arrested, and about half have already been deported. Approximately 112 people have self-deported. Only 12% of those arrested had previous criminal violations. Vic Bedoyan reporting for the Pacifica Evening News and KFCF Radio.
In national news, Trump escalating in Caribbean with aircraft carrier strike group, more boat bombings, as Venezuela leader pleads for peace. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
President Donald Trump has made dubious boasts of stopping or preventing wars in hotspots around the globe. But in the Western Hemisphere, he's taking a far more combative approach, with bombing attacks, stealth fighters and bombers, the CIA, and now an aircraft carrier strike group. A day earlier, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro released a video with an appeal in English.
Not war! Not war! Just peace! Just peace! Just peace! Forever, forever, forever. Peace forever. No crazy war. No a la guerra loca. No crazy. No crazy war. No crazy war. Please, please, please. Yes, peace. Peace forever. Peace forever. Victory forever defeats. Victory forever defeats.
Maduro's plea came after Trump announced he's authorized the CIA to take covert action against Venezuela. But Maduro's words did not sway President Trump, who followed up with a threat to go beyond attacking supposed drug boats.
So now they're coming in by land, and even the land is concerned because I told them that's going to be next. You know, the land is going to be next.
From there, things only escalated. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth announced Friday the U.S. has carried out another strike on a suspected drug-running boat, killing six people. It's the 10th such strike since September 2nd, with at least 43 people killed in the attacks. Many experts question the legality of the attacks, and some lawmakers have proposed war powers legislation to block the strikes. But Trump claims he has the legal authority to carry them out.
Well, I don't think we're going to necessarily ask for a declaration of war. I think we're just going to kill people that are bringing drugs into our country. Okay? We're going to kill them. You know? They're going to be, like, dead. Okay?
And now the Pentagon is deploying its most advanced aircraft carrier to the Caribbean. The USS Gerald Ford, along with its advanced fighter jets and accompanying warships, is being deployed from the Mediterranean to the coast of Venezuela. The escalating moves have brought criticism from Latin American leaders. Colombian President Gustavo Petro called the strikes murder, saying the U.S. government's strategy breaks the norms of international law. Brazil's President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva says he'd like to discuss the issue when he meets with Trump Sunday. He says you can't just say you're going to invade and fight drug trafficking in other people's land without taking into account the constitution of other countries, the self-determination of peoples, if it goes against the territorial sovereignty of each country. Trump says his actions are a response to drug smuggling by Venezuela, but many observers think Trump is really trying to destabilize the Venezuelan government and remove President Nicolas Maduro from power. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
And in National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Gila River Indian community in Arizona has long relied on convenience stores to feed its 13,000 residents, who otherwise may have to drive as far as half an hour away to neighboring cities with grocery stores. But as KJZZ's Gabriel Piatrazio reports, a new market a decade in the making has opened much closer to home.
This isn't a Bash's, it's not a Safeway or a Walmart.
Duncan Winston with Gila River Development says the tribe's new 14,000 square foot supermarket in the heart of Sacaton is much more than a store. It's a symbol of their sovereignty, since few, if any, tribes outright own their own grocers.
We don't want to leave that in the hands of a larger chain to determine who gets what. We want to be able to fight for ourselves and bring the necessary goods to our community when we need them.
From fresh produce and butchered meats to a deli serving local favorites, like the Works Burger.
One of the biggest demands from the community was you got to bring the Works back, and so we've done that.
But that doesn't come cheap because of what some refer to as resflation.
We have experienced it here. I mean, it's difficult finding reputable vendors who are willing to bring us goods and services at a fair price. Although we are rural, we are a lot closer to the metropolitan Phoenix area than a lot of the other tribes in Arizona.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Piatrazio.
Sea Alaska Heritage Institute recently opened its new science education building. The space and the educators inside are working to combine traditional knowledge with new technology to expand access to science for young people in Juneau, Alaska. KTOO's Yvonne Crumry reports.
At a ceremony, Tlingit language professor Hune Lance Twitchell said that bringing traditional ways of being into the present isn't a contradiction.
It's not a living in two world situation. It's living as an indigenous person with multiple languages and multiple identities and being just fine with it. You don't have to be just one thing.
And the new SHI Indigenous Science Building around the corner carries that sentiment in all the services it offers. The building on Heritage Way hosts a digital media lab with a podcast booth and video production software, an Indigenous science research lab that studies cultural resources like seaweed and clams, and a maker space with a digital wood carving machine. That last one made name tags instructors are wearing as they lead tours of the new building. In the traditional foods and medicine kitchen, instructor Seichtin Jamian Hasselquist says she and others are bringing old ways to process and preserve food into the present.
Whatever people can dream up that they would like to do in this kitchen, I think that we could try to make their dreams happen.
With freeze dryers, pressure cookers, dehydrators, and space to build traditional drying racks, Hasselquist says they're making and preserving traditional foods that elders would make when she was a kid, like cheese kahak, a rich and smoky paste made of fermented salmon eggs. She scoops some out of a glass jar and spreads it on a cracker for anyone who wants to try it.
Someone tasted that cheese kahak, and they took one bite, and they said, oh my gosh, I'm getting emotional. I haven't tasted this for 30 years. It's been 3 decades, and they thought that they would never try it again.
Elders have been approaching Hasselquist with foods they remember from childhood but don't know how to make.
If we could have workshops and share that knowledge, and we're rebirthing, you know, this indigenous way of living and being.
Next, she wants to find out how to make cold-pressed seal grease. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumry.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Javier Rodriguez, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Elise Cox, Vic Bedoyan, Christopher Martinez, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online, and you can find us on kmud.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605. Or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMud, I'm Nat Cardos.